Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Texas Farmers Insurance Company versus Soriano.
May it please the court, Mr. Ben Taylor will present argument from petitioners reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Ben Taylor. I'm here today with Wendell Hall from our firm. This is a Stowers case, also seeking to establish liability for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. The parties in the case are Richard Soriano, who is the plaintiff, Texas Farmers Insurance Company, which is our client and the defendant, and there's also a third-party defendant. Farmers brought in the Tilley Law Firm, Offworth, Keith, and O'Reilly. The facts giving rise to this litigation are tragic, and they start in the late 1970s. Because the court has granted legal issues, our points bear on legal issues. I'm going to be brief in reciting the facts, but they are pretty lengthy. The case started with a road trip by Soriano and some friends. They crossed the border from Laredo into Mexico and visited the red light district. They came back the following morning. Soriano was driving. He was intoxicated. He crossed over the center line and collided with the car going the other way. The results of the accident were tragic in both cars. Soriano's passenger, Adolfo Lopez, who was 18, was killed. In the other car was a family, the Medina family. Mrs. Medina was killed. Mr. Medina was seriously injured, and the two Medina children, Tommy and Alicia, were also seriously injured. Soriano did not have insurance coverage. Instead, his parents had a policy with Texas Farmers. The limits on the policy were minimal, $10,000 liability per person and $20,000 total per occurrence. Farmers looked at this file and initially decided to try to offer the entire $20,000 to the Medina family. The Medinas rejected that offer and instead decided to hire a lawyer. They hired Attorney Van Huseman from Corpus Christi. Huseman then started an investigation into whether Soriano had personal assets that might justify pursuing the claim against him in excess of the $20,000 limit. Meanwhile, the parents of Adolfo Lopez, the deceased passenger, they filed a lawsuit in Webb County. The Medinas also filed a lawsuit in Webb County. These lawsuits eventually were consolidated to be tried together. The attorney representing the Lopez family Stowerized Farmers offered to settle the Lopez claim for $5,000. While the jury was being selected, that offer was accepted, and Farmers then offered the remaining $15,000 to the Medinas family. The Medinas rejected that offer and instead proceeded to trial against Soriano. The result in the Webb County trial was a judgment against Soriano for $172,000. That was far in excess of the liability coverage he had. That judgment was affirmed in a 1983 no-writ case. Afterwards, Soriano got together with the Medina's attorney, Van Huseman, and allegedly assigned all rights that he has in this lawsuit to the Medina's. In exchange for that alleged assignment, the Medina's agreed not to covenant, they covenanted not to execute against Soriano. We now come to the present lawsuit. Soriano sues Texas Farmers Insurance Company as the nominal plaintiff, tells the jury through his lawyers and through his own testimony that he's not getting a penny out of this lawsuit. The case is submitted to the jury on a number of special issues. The court has before it copies of the liability issues that were submitted. The result of that trial in Duval County is a verdict and a judgment awarding Soriano actual and punitive damages in excess of $6 million. After a lengthy appeal, a majority of the Fourth Court of Appeals in San Antonio deleted the prejudgment interest that was awarded on top of the Stowers interest and also ordered Soriano to remit $4 million out of the $5 million punitive award. Farmers is before the court on a number of points of error. The court has indicated which points it would like to hear a discussion on. I'm going to address those points, but we don't waive any of the other points, and we believe the entire case is before the court for a decision. The first point the court has granted is a straight no-duty point. This is our first point of error in the Supreme Court. Farmers says, and we believe this court should hold, that it had a right under the policy to settle with third parties on a first-come, first-served basis. There's no evidence and there's no contention that standing alone it was unreasonable or negligent to accept the $5,000 settlement demand. The only argument that has been made and the evidence that has been presented is that you have to somehow evaluate the comparative risk of the Medina claims as opposed to the Lopez claims.
If Lopez had made a $20,000 demand on the day of trial,
it was a $5,000 demand, Your Honor.
I understand.
And
if Lopez had made a $20,000 demand, could farmers have paid that and your position would be the same?
That would certainly make us look worse if we had paid all that money to him. It puts us in the same catch-22.
I mean, you did pay, you paid five times your reserves to Lopez in this case. Five times the amount you initially reserved for the Lopez claim.
Yes, Your Honor. We initially...
I'm just trying to test, is your no-duty standard a pure no-duty standard, or is there a little bit of duty?
It is probably a little bit of duty if you get to the question of whether there has to be a finding that the first settlement is negligent, and the cases all say that the insurance company has a right in good faith to accept any settlement offer. So,
well, now they don't all say. Respondents cite about as many cases as you do seem to set up at least a limited duty.
They do have one federal case interpreting New York law where they talk about the possibility that the insurance company made an overeager settlement of one claim in disregard of the possible liability to other claimants. And that case reversed a directed verdict, so it didn't address what would happen.
And there's some summary judgment cases.
Well, actually, the one case they've relied on that I think really helps us is Farmers Insurance versus Schropp case, which is actually a judgment awarding extra contractual damages. And we believe that case supports us instead of supporting Soriano, because when the first settlement offer was made, the insurance company, instead of just accepting it, they tried to be fair. It was actually a farmer's company, tried to apportion among the various claimants, and they actually interpleaded the money, which is a suggestion that's been made by two of the judges on the Court of Appeals, and they got tagged for extra contractual liability on the theory that they could have and presumably should have settled as each claim was presented with an offer to settle within the limits.
Would interpleader have solved this whole problem?
All it would do, if it's accepted, at all, if it's permitted at all, is just throw to the court the burden of doing this.
Well, wouldn't it have removed any problem for your carrier?
Well, Your Honor, there is nothing in the majority opinion or the concurring opinion that says that would wipe out our extra contractual liability of matter of law. All they say, just the
What would you advise the court? I mean, if your carrier promptly tendered its full policy, knowing of the tremendous exposure it had in this case, would it be your view that would remove all of your extra contractual
if this court were to declare that we should do that, and then we did do that, I think that would, absolutely. There'd be no way the insurance company could be subject to liability in this comparative situation after it followed a pronouncement from a court.
And here your carrier made a deliberate decision not to do that.
Well, I'd like to talk about the record on that, because the Court of Appeals, in our opinion, has misstated the record. We have that in our motion for rehearing.
Okay.
There are two letters in this record.
Counsel, before you move on to something else, doesn't the stakeholder who interpleads funds ordinarily have a right to attorney's fees out of the funds that are pled into the registry of the court?
That is correct. There is a right to attorney's fees under this court's precedent.
Which would not help the injured parties or their families in this instance, would it?
It would not. I want to address now.
Yes, if you could address my question, then I'd appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor. The letters that were sent to farmers were sent by the Tilley attorney. The first letter says, I wish to explore with you the advisability of stipulating negligence on the part of our insured and tendering limits into the registry. That's Farmers Exhibit 2, Volume 8 of the Statement of Facts, page 180. There's a response back from Philip Jackson, who was working on this claim, and his response was, you have full authority to settle for the $20,000. I would be very concerned about stipulating negligence on the part of our insured unless we have written consent from both the insured and the insured's personal attorney. I think that's a very reasonable response. It is not a refusal, as the Court of Appeals found as fact, and there is no finding of fact. There's one other letter later on where Mr. Offworth says, we are considering advisability and or methods of tendering limits into the registry of the court in as much as there are two dead people, several seriously injured people, and the damages are expected to far exceed policy limits. The testimony from Mr. Jackson was that he doesn't know whether it's even legally permissible to interplead funds, and he doesn't know if Mr. Offworth ever figured out a way to do it. Mr. Offworth ended up dying unrelated to this dispute, but so we don't, there's nothing further on the record. So as far as any suggestion that Farmers was advised by its attorney to do this and steadfastly refused, that is at best an argumentative statement. We think it's untrue and it's not
supported. What is it that would have made it legally impermissible to interplead the funds?
Well, this court has recently held in Allstate Insurance Company versus Watson, which came back down on rehearing, that the insurance company owes its duty only to the insured and not to the third party. Until there's a judgment establishing liability against the insured, there is no claim that the injured third party has directly against the insurance company. The only authority in Texas for interpleader is this court's Rule 43. And Rule 43 says persons having claims against the plaintiff may be interpleaded as defendant. So if the insurance company takes a $20,000 check and takes it to Catherine Tyra's office and says, I want you to put this into the registry of court, Ms. Tyra's going to say, what is your authority for that? You go get an order from a judge that says, I have to take this money. The district court, I know from experience, from settlements, they won't take any money into a registry unless you've got an order that says they have to do it. They don't want to be responsible for that money. And we have a big question about whether there's any authority whatsoever for interpleading.
Did Farmers attempt to tender the policy limits in this case?
No, Your Honor, there's no evidence they did.
But I mean, under Tilly, if you're insured, claims it's not, well, the mere tendering of your policy limits into the registry of the court would not extinguish your client's liability for extra damages. Is that correct?
Under this opinion, it would not.
And would that be a violation of the Tilly duty for the insurance company, who owes the primary obligation to the insured to make a written pleading in the court, throwing up its hands and saying, we confess liability up to the amount of $20,000, and here it is. I mean, could you do that under Tilly, absent your insurance approval?
My understanding of Tilly, Your Honor, is it only addresses the attorney's duty to represent ultimately.
Well, could you do it under policy then?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Soriano did not put the insurance policy in the record. That the policy is not in the record at all.
Well, is there any legal problem? Perhaps there's no legal problem here with doing that.
The only way that the interpleader can be done is if the district clerk and the district judge accepts it. My understanding is that in order to file a lawsuit in Texas, you have to have a cause of action. And my understanding is that you can't just go to a court and file a lawsuit unless you have a statute or a case that gives you a cause of action. Now, if this court decides either to rewrite Rule 43 or just to create an interpleader cause of action, we also think that the court should declare that the insurance company is going to be protected if it follows this court's decision creating a cause of action. And it will also have to decide, under the case law we've cited, who has to pay the insurance, the attorney's fees for filing that lawsuit. And it's going to have to declare what principles the judge applies in deciding who gets the money.
Is it necessary in such a lawsuit to concede the liability? Or to concede, more particularly, to concede negligence of the insurer?
I guess this court would have to tell us, Your Honor, because there's
no law on that.
There is no law that says in Texas that we have a right to do this. The only law in Texas that we have that lets anyone interplead anything is Rule 43, and since there's no claim that the, I guess the defendants would be Mr. Soriano, the Lopez family, and the Medinas, none of those people have a claim against us, but we're going to ignore that and file a Rule 43 interpleader. If the court creates this kind of cause of action, the court's going to have to tell us what the elements are and what the required facts are. Otherwise, we don't have any authority for this cause of action.
Mr. Taylor, if you had paid money in the registry of the court, would you have settled either one of these lawsuits?
That's something that the bad faith law report tells us about, and I don't know what the answer to that is.
But the fact that you paid Mr. Lopez $5,000, in fact, settled that lawsuit.
Right, we got full relief of those claims.
So as a result of the insurance company's actions, one of the two lawsuits was settled. Is there any dispute in the record at all about that?
There's no dispute in the record.
The question is, by settling one lawsuit, did you violate some sort of duty to Mr. Soriano by not being thereby able to settle a second lawsuit?
I think that is the question.
If you had paid the money in the registry of the court, would you have settled either of the lawsuits?
Not at all. There's no evidence that the Medinas, or, and particularly Mr. Van Heusman, was willing to settle anything other than part of the Medina claim, and he wanted every penny of the $20,000, and he wouldn't take a penny less. There have been some statements made that the Medinas were willing to settle everything for $20,000 before the Lopez case settled, and we think that they should have to provide a record reference for that, but that's not in the record. That appears in the majority's opinion, but it's not in the record, and it's not true.
Most of your briefing seems to turn on both sides on the issues we've raised. Seems to turn on preservation of error in the trial court.
And I'm only going to have a moment because my time is running.
Well, we may ask you some questions. But
I'd be delighted
of that. And answer me specifically. I know that the attorney in the trial court made extensive objections. Was there any attempt to tender any instructions that would accompany Special Issues 1, 2, or 3?
There was, and the majority opinion below quoted at length what's in the supplemental transcript. That was not a point of error that I raised in the Court of Appeals. Those instructions that he tendered were based on Justice Gonzalez's dissent, and I think correct dissent in the Gwynn case, about all the problems created by allowing conditional offers to be the predicate for a Stowers claim. But we decided not to raise that point, and now we have an opinion that analyzes preservation based on part of the record that we weren't even relying on. But in answer to your question, Judge, we did not tender an instruction on this.
Well, on anything about conflicting demands.
Right. What the record reflects is that Mr. Soriano elected to submit a negligence question that inquired only about the manner in which farmers handled the claim asserted for the death of Maria Medina and the injuries to Carlos Medina. It was only such negligence that he submitted. That under, regardless of preservation, Rule 279 specifically provides that all independent grounds of recovery, not conclusively establishment of the evidence, no element of which is requested or submitted, are waived. So we have, I think it's going to be undisputed, there's certainly a dispute in the evidence about whether the Medina settlement, whether the Lopez settlement was negligent. That is not in any way referable, and certainly not necessarily referable to this special issue. It is not a broad form question, as Mr. Soriano and the majority below would have the court believe. So under Rule 279, it's Soriano who's in the waiver position because he submitted a special issue and he did not request any issue on the propriety of the Lopez settlement. In fact, his jury arguments make it really clear that he wasn't even trying to establish that. He said that the issue about the Lopez people was a rabbit trail, not the question. In his closing argument, he says you have to value the case in a comparative way. That's at page 908 of the Statement of Facts. What he's saying is that we have to base our decision on whether the Lopez claim or instead the Medina claim is more valuable. Well, that ignores the fact, and it's an undisputed fact, that there was a potential Stowers case coming out of the Lopez claim, and we're entitled under the law to consider our own potential Stowers liability. It's not exclusively consideration of the insured's interest. But besides Soriano's waiver as a result of letting his charge go to the jury without a special issue on the Lopez settlement, This is something that we tried to bring to court's attention. Our trial counsel pointed out during the charge conference that the central issue in the lawsuit is settlement of the Lopez claim. Nowhere in the charge does it address that issue. That's where all the expert opinions went. The judge knew that that was the problem. And I admit this is before the formal charge objection. Soriano responded to this argument. I've run out of space here. He admitted that we were complaining
But you just made the critical point, didn't you, that this was before the formal charge objection.
Right.
And isn't the trial judge entitled to have discussion back and forth between counsel and then have the only objection on which he can be reversed, that which is made in the formal objection to the charge?
Will the court entertain discussion about this?
You may answer any questions for counsel.
And I would sure like to have 2 or 3 minutes rebuttal, if I may.
Is there rebuttal remaining?
Oh.
I thought there's still 5 minutes.
You still
these
have 5 minutes.
These
you
lights
answer
are
that
the
question,
initial plan.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's true. At the same time, there is the judge said he thought we were making objections. Our trial counsel said I still need to make my formal objection. We believe that this, and now we're up to page 1920. This is where the formal objection was made. The entire case with respect to how the claims handling was handled, and all the opinions address the issue of whether or not the Lopez claim should be settled to submit the issues as stated to concrete evidence, concrete pleadings, and theories of the case been advised on. So we believe that repeated the objection and was sufficient under this court's decision in Payne. I think even under the dissenting opinion that Justice Gonzalez ultimately joined on rehearing, it's sufficient because we alerted the judge to what was being omitted from the charge. Nothing was in the charge on whether or not the Lopez claim should have been settled or not.
Mr. Taylor, this language that you have there in the middle of the chart is in the midst of a whole lot of verbiage about the conditional offer that you have not preserved in your opinion. And standing alone, it would be very tempting to me, based on our precedent, to say this was buried and did not call it to the trial judge's attention. Do you have any authority, one way or the other, about whether we can look to the discussions prior to the formal charge, that is, the 10 pages, some of which you quoted up there, to inform us on whether or not the formal objection itself is sufficiently detailed and sufficiently referenced to the charge to make sense to the trial judge? In other words, do we just look at the naked objections to the charge without considering the discussion, or can we consider that discussion and put the objections in context?
My authority on that, Your Honor, would be State Department of Highways and Public Transportation versus Payne. There were a lot of tenders in that case, and in addition, Your Honor, the tender that was made on whether Mr. Payne had knowledge of the defect, the alleged special defect in that case, it had the burden of proof backwards, and this court recognized that what's at work here is people struggling to collect their thoughts and say the final words they're going to say to the jury. The question is whether timely and plainly the party made the trial court aware of the complaint and he obtained a ruling. We think that was done repeatedly in this case. As far as the obfuscation suggestion you're raising, Judge Phelps, that's in Rule 274. But the rule requires numerous unfounded objections and untenable requests. Now, he did go on at length, and if you read his objections, he talks about the problem with conditional offers. Now, that's something that Justice Gonzalez wrote about at length, and Justice Spears joined him in the Gwynn case, that if you have this cat-and-mouse game, people won't make a full offer to settle. That shouldn't be the predicate for a Stowers claim. We know under Rule 13 that parties are entitled to preserve positions, even if they're contrary to existing law, and we know from the General Chemical versus De La Lostra case that this court tags parties if they don't object on the basis of what may later become the law. So while we decided that we were not going to ask the court, and ultimately we don't need to ask the court to overrule Gwynn, we're not in a position of having made numerous unfounded objections. Instead, we objected on the basis of what Judge Gonzalez said, and I think that our objections are straightforward. And I appreciate the court's indulgence.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess. court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Ronald Brand and Mr. Thomas Nye will present argument for respondents. Mr. Brand will present first 22 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice,
members of the court,
and please the court. I'm Ron Brenn with the firm of Brenn & Brenn from Corpus Christi, and I was trial counsel in the case below. Mr. Nye and I will argue this case. I will present our opposition in response to the granted points of error of the petitioner and Mr. Nye, time allowing, and with the court's permission, will present the respondent's granted points of error with respect to our contention that this case should be remanded to the Court of Appeals for a proper review under the proper standard of care with respect to the question of miniature punitive damages. I realize that the court wants me to argue the law in this case, and I am prepared to do that. I think, at the court's indulgence, if you would allow me to highlight some of the factual admissions that farmers made at the trial, which are part of this record, that will help the court understand our position and put my argument into better context. I'll take only a few minutes of the court's time to do that. With the court's permission, I would like to point out that in the trial of this case, there were requests for admissions under Rule 169 read into evidence and presented to the jury. Specifically, there was number 9A, by which farmers admitted judicially that they intentionally and knowingly settled the Lopez claim at a time when the claims for the death of Maria Medina and the injuries to Carlos Medina could have been settled for policy limits of $20,000. Request for admission 9B, which was read into evidence, established that farmers admitted that they intentionally and knowingly settled the Lopez claim at a time when farmers knew that to do so would take the coverage limits below the amount necessary to meet the settlement demands in the Medina death claim and the serious Carlos Medina injury claim.
Mr. Brennan, in that score, let me ask you, is it your position, I mean, did you establish at the time this case was tried that the Lopez family had no claim as a matter of law against Soriano? That Lopez family had no claim against Soriano at the time this case was tried. At the time they paid $5,000 to the Lopez family, is it your position that at that time, as a matter of law, there was no claim by Lopez against Soriano?
This is correct. They settled that case at the time that case had been settled at the time this case.
But you're saying at the time they knowingly paid $5,000 to Lopez, they knew that would reduce the amount they'd have available to pay to Medina. And I'm saying,
yes.
Is it your position as a matter of law that Lopez had no claim against Soriano?
After they settled, they didn't.
Well, okay. Then the answer to my question is that Lopez did, in fact, have a valid claim against...
Oh, yes. To put it that way, yes, I understand what you're saying.
At the time they paid. Well, if that's the case, then is it your position that $5,000 was too much money for settlement for Lopez?
Viewed in the context of the entire submitted claims against Soriano, yes, it is our position.
Now, Mr. Lopez here died as a result of this accident.
Yes, the younger Lopez died, yes.
And $5,000 in the context of this case was too much money for that. And that's what you say is undisputed. What
we're saying, Your Honor, is that the law requires that the carrier look beyond just looking at that case all by itself and look at the totality of the claims asserted against the insurer.
Is there any possible situation where demands from multiple claimants exceed the amount of the insurance policy? Is there any situation where the insurance company could settle those claims without a future bad faith exposure? Or is this any time an insurance company has a $20,000 policy and it's more than $20,000 in claims, there will be trials under your standard that result, further trials will result for that for mental anguish and punitive damages?
No, not necessarily. I think what the...
would have satisfied you here?
What would have satisfied me here is that the...
I mean, conceding there was that you had a $20,000 demand, and we'll assume that that's unconditional on the table, and they had a $5,000 demand, what would have said it? Of course, the insurance company could have paid $25,000 and gone away, but they, and they had no legal obligation to. What would have satisfied you on a split here?
Well, the only thing that satisfied us was that they would have paid the $20,000 demand.
So if they paid $19,999 to you and a dollar to Lopez, family for Lopez's death, then you would say there would be mental anguish and punitive damages claims that would follow.
If what they did, if the demand was clearly and unequivocally for the $20,000 for the two largest cases, and that was put squarely to them, and they chose of their own volition to offer anything less, if they did anything that would cause the larger cases to have to go to trial against their insured, yes, sir, Your Honor, they have violated the duty that's announced.
If you represented the Lopez and an insurance company chose to pay $20,000 to the people, to the Medina, the people who made the second claim, that got their demand in order in the second place, would the Lopez's have a claim for the $0 they were paid? They just wouldn't. I mean, they'd say, we have a death here, and we wanted a dollar, and they said no. And that's a summary judgment case.
In my view, that it is, Your Honor.
Now, how do we write that? What if it's not clear which the most serious claim is?
Then the insurance company just has to do the best they can to evaluate.
But they do buy a lawsuit that way. I mean, the rival claimants have the right to test the insurance company's judgment in court.
It is possible that they could buy a lawsuit, but under the facts of this case, if they bought one, I think it would be a summary judgment case for them, because the admissions in this case are that the Lopez death claim nowhere approached the value of the two cases that they failed to settle, and they've admitted that in the record during trial testimony, and that was the next thing that I was going to get to. With respect to the
anytime one claim is more, let's say there's a $20,000 policy and there's a claim that's reasonably a $700,000 claim and a claim that's reasonably a $600,000 claim. Your standard would be the claim that the insurance company thinks is $700,000 gets the entire policy amount. And any split less than that is a bad faith lawsuit.
If they cannot settle both claims within limits, and they know that, then their duty is to use it, and Farmers has admitted this in the case, and it's also our view of what the law is, and their duty is to then use the limits to give the most protection to the insured for the dollars that they have to spend. And if it's $600,000 versus $700,000, then they need to settle the case that's worth $700,000 worth of limits.
What's that criteria they use? Help us to enunciate some standard by which these cases can be viewed by the Benton Bar. If you were writing the opinion, how would you write it?
I would write it that in a case like this, that the insurance company has a four-pronged test to be used for proper behavior whenever there are multiple claims in excess of the policy limits to be submitted. The first of these is to investigate thoroughly and promptly. The next is, after having done that and realized that this is a situation, to notify all parties that there are more in claims values than there are limits. The next thing that they need to do is to attempt affirmatively with reasonable procedures to try to settle all cases within the limits without insisting that it be done that way, but make a reasonable attempt to do so. And finally, failing all else, if they cannot do that, then they must evaluate the cases and spend the money that they have to settle the cases in a manner which is the most protection to their insured. And Farmers has admitted this in the testimony, and it is our position that is exactly what the G.A. Stowers Furniture Company mandates.
Under that standard, there would be very little incentive to settle a case. I mean, the insurance company should never pay a nickel to anyone who they don't think has the most serious claim. So if there's any dispute about that, no case is going to settle. If it's absolutely clear, you've got the most serious claim. That's the only likelihood in which a case might settle. And if it doesn't settle, you know, the exposure is the same for the insurance company either way.
Well, let me give you an analogy, if I could, Your Honor, just a hypothetical situation that I think sets forth what you're saying. Let's say that you had a 5100 policy, and the insured undoubtedly caused an accident, and there were three quadriplegics involved in the case. And all of them had cases much, much more in excess of policy limits. I think that under the test that I gave to the court a moment ago, there's a good chance that all those cases could settle, but if they can't, then the insurance company can't just abdicate its responsibility to its insured. It will be required to analyze which of those three quadriplegic cases are the worst ones, and if they won't settle for any less than the limits, any of them, then you buy the most you can with the policy that you have, because otherwise the insurer is going to go to trial in all three quadriplegic cases. So you eliminate as much as you can with the money that you have if your other efforts have failed.
Even in this case, it's not, and even under the standards prior to Sanchez, it's not out of the realm of possibility that the Lopez parents could have gotten a judgment in excess of $172,000 had they gone to trial in Webb County in 1983, is it?
Well, I think the insurance company would be dealing not with what is out of the realm of, in the realm of possibility, but rather what in their experience will probably happen if the case is tried. And the jury heard evidence on that by various experts.
Pretty much the interpleader has been suggested as a solution to this problem. Would you tell us what your views are on that proposal?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think that's a solution at all. I don't think the insurance company can just abdicate its responsibility to its insurer by throwing it into the court and telling the court to handle it. There's been a mention that this puts the insurance company in a catch-22, which is a no-win situation, and I disagree with that. Now, I will agree that, as Chief Justice Phillips mentioned, that sometimes it's a difficult situation, but that's kind of like standing at this podium. No one said it was going to be easy. They collect a premium for this, and they have a responsibility, when a case comes up, to make hard decisions sometimes. That's just part of business. And it is their obligation, as mandated by the Stowers case, to exercise reasonable care in the way they handle the asserted claims against the insured, viewed from the insured's standpoint. And I take issue with the statement that Farmers made that they have a right to consider their own Stowers interest. If they do, it is secondary to the interest of their insured.
Suppose we had a minimum policy and a busload of people that have been hurt. You don't think that the insurer can promptly tender and interplead its policy and thereby fulfill its duty to its policyholders?
I do not, that's so.
Well, what happens when they've got, instead of two or three people, half a dozen people? Because that sometimes happens with a policy.
Maybe
25 or 30, and you've got deaths and serious injuries. Is the insurance company to be exposed to a lawsuit or series of lawsuits in every one of those cases for punitive damages and so forth?
Not if they have made a reasonable analysis after prompt, quick investigation as to which of those cases, if they can't settle them all for the limits, then if they, I don't care if there's 10 or 5 or whatever there are, I agree with you that it would make the situation more threatening to the insured, but the insurance company has to do the best that they can, and if they just interplead this and there are 15 claims, there are going to be 15 lawsuits and 15 excess judgments. It would be far better for there to be 13 rather than 15 and get two of the major cases out of the way if those people will take the minimum limits. And so that's our position in the case, and it was the testimony before the jury that is what the insurance company should do. We had testimony that they did not do that. Our position is it's a simple Stowers case, and that they did not follow the mandates of due care. As a matter of fact, the evidence in this case even shows that the personal lawyer for Mr. Soriano expressed displeasure and objection to the locust settlement before it was ever consummated, in terms of Mr. Alanese's testimony that he told farmers through his defense lawyer that he hoped that they wouldn't do that, and they did it anyway. The jury was entitled to take that into consideration.
Mr. Brand, is there some indication in the record that Mr. Soriano may actually have an interest in the outcome of this lawsuit by way of the divorce property settlement?
Your Honor, that is, if I may respond to that by without waiving anything in terms that is totally outside the record in this case, but to comment on that, I don't think the fact that he has now decided that perhaps that now that there's actually has been a recovery that he can figure out some way to share in it is not really relevant to this case, and it is outside the record. But to respond to your question, there have been papers filed in this court that would suggest that he is not taking that position.
On your balancing issue, I understand in answer to the Chief's question, you're saying it's really an all or nothing deal. Once you determine what's got who's heavier on the scales, and they get it all. But the judgment in favor of the Medinas and the original lawsuit was $170-some thousand. If Lopez's death was only worth a third of that, hasn't the insurance company satisfied its balancing test? They paid $5,000 to the Lopez family and three times that amount to the Medina family, and isn't that, couldn't the insurance company argue that we balanced the issues here? I mean, you talk in terms of balancing, then it's an all or nothing deal. But clearly, isn't the death worth $30,000 or $40,000 or not?
Not at that time, Your Honor. And I think that the reasoning in Sanchez versus Schindler, when this court changed the law, indicated that these type of cases were, by reason of the then state of the law, worth virtually nothing, and sometimes even a negative value. And I think that we have to deal with the context of the law that existed at that time. And we had an adult death case before this court changed the law of Sanchez versus Schindler. And the simple evidence in the case to the jury was that the insurance company had a duty to settle the case, protect the insured with the money available, and give him the most protection. The evidence by the experts to the jury was that they did not do this. The jury had a right to believe that. They did believe it. They found negligence and gross negligence. One last thing that I wanted to mention in the part that I started out with, which were some of the admissions of farmers. Farmers now takes a position that we need to look at this case just based upon the value of Lopez alone and see whether it was reasonable or not. That's not the position that they admitted to at trial. They admitted at trial that they had an obligation to take all things into consideration, not just the value of the claim itself. They said that to get the ultimate protection was what their duty was, and that to get the ultimate protection for Soriano, you would choose to settle the case within limits that had the greater amount of exposure if you take all things into consideration. And farmers admitted that they were supposed to take all things into consideration.
Is that a formal admission?
Beg pardon?
Is that a formal admission or a testimony?
That was a testimonial admission by the representative of farmers at trial under question.
Mr. Brand, the four-pronged test which you propose that we write into our opinion, would you characterize that as a new rule of law, or would you say that's standard that is established under the current law?
That is gleaned and gathered from this court's other opinions about what the duty of the insurance company is, the carrier. If you look at the recent opinion that the court wrote in the Canal case involving the excess carrier, it talked about the duty of the insurance carrier is a broad one and extends into the trial of the case and into settlement negotiations.
Do you agree that this is a case of first impression insofar as it addresses competing claims as opposed to the duty owed to a solitary and to an insured based on a single claim?
I know of no other cases written on in Texas that have addressed the duty that, in particular, that the Stowers case imposes whenever there are multiple claims as decided in Texas. But if I might add, Justice Garn, that is silent testimony in and of itself to the fact that insurance companies for lo these many years have been able to, since 1929 when Stowers was decided, use that as a guideline and use some common sense about how to protect their insured. If they were just dealing willy-nilly without having any idea, not being guided by Stowers, we would have seen this case before this court long ago.
Mr. Brand, Ms. Taylor mentioned that there was some discussion, there has been in the record, that the Medinas made a final demand for $20,000 and would have settled the case, but they went ahead and paid the $5,000 below pass, and that messed up the deal. And Mr. Taylor has made the comment that there was no final demand for $20,000. There were some conditions in addition to $20,000. Could you respond to that?
Well, there were two situations. Yes, I will respond to it. There were two situations. It is totally undisputed by farmers that there was a $20,000 demand for the two most serious Medina cases, and that's not in the dispute. What I understand you're asking me about is a question of whether or not there's any testimony in the record as to whether or not all of the Medina cases could have been settled for $20,000 before the Lopez case was settled. So if I understand what you're asking, that's on
the my understanding of the record, there was clearly the Medina said we're not going to settle for $20,000 early on. Then, that's about the time of trial when there was some argument that they paid Lopez knowing they could have settled the Medina case for $20,000. So I'm talking about that second period of time, which Mr. Taylor responded, said, well, they say that, but the fact is we could not have settled the Medina cases that second period of time. And that's what I was looking to see what the response was.
If you look on page 304 of the statement of facts, you will see what that is substantiated by Mr. Houston's testimony at the trial court.
Following your test, would it apply when there are divisible claims by a single plaintiff? For example, if a single plaintiff said, well, we won't settle the whole case, but we'll settle for the policy limits, this aspect of the case, mental anguish or future pain and suffering or punitive damages or some aspect of our claim.
That has not come up in this case and has not come up in my experience. I would say that what we're talking about in terms of the company's duty in general is to make settlements rather than to make advances. And I don't know that would be incumbent upon the insurance company to make advances against a proposed or
I don't mean to suggest in advance. I mean to suggest that the party would actually relinquish part of his claim in exchange for the policy limits. And under your proposed test, the insurance company would then be buying some protection for the insured by tendering the limits, although it wouldn't be full protection. But it might be the most they could get under the circumstances.
Well, all right, then my answer to that, Your Honor, is that if that's what a reasonably prudent insured would do, if he had no insurance and could buy his protection the best way he could out of his own pocket, viewed from his standpoint, if that's what a reasonably insured would have done with his own money to protect himself, then that's what the insurance company's got to do. And I think that's what the Stowers case says.
If we invite you a little more time, are you going to let Mr. Knight?
How much time do I have? I didn't see the light come on here. Could I have 1 minute to, I never got to address the...
We'll give you 1 minute and Mr. Knight.
All right, if I could have just 1 minute here to address the contention that we lose this case because the question of the reasonableness of the Lopez case was not submitted. That is just their argument as to why they're not liable for not settling the two big cases, that the question of which was submitted to the jury. Inferentially, they say Lopez settlement was reasonable, and therefore the failure to settle the other cases because we didn't have enough money, we couldn't help it, and therefore it wasn't negligent. That is an inferential rebuttal issue that's prohibited by Rule 277, and if anything, if it's got to be submitted at all, it should be by instruction, which was never asked for. Secondly, it's evidentiary. Third, it's subsumed in the broad form submission that we used, of which we tried to evade the mandates of this court in submitting it broadly under Rule 277.
Is your broad form argument undercut by the nature of your argument to the jury in final argument? This is a rabbit trail. I mean, can the court look at that? Could we say that is subsumed evidentiary under Island Recreation, but look at what counsel did with it in final argument?
Well,
told the jury not to consider it.
That was taken out of context, Your Honor. I mean, I'm arguing to a jury that I don't want to make mad at me by suggesting that this boy's death was nothing. And that wasn't the point that we were trying to make. It's just that under the state of the law, that the cases that they refused to settle were higher in value as per the testimony of the experts, and that we weren't trying to insult anyone and saying that their child's death was meaningless and that the child was worthless. And that was what the position that they were putting me in argument, that was just response to their argument. And that's all that it was. And it's not inconsistent at all from the position that we've taken from the very beginning of this case.
Any further questions for Mr. Brown? Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I appreciate the 3 minutes of additional time in which to speak to this court. I'd like to divide this time as follows. 1 minute talking about our application for writ of error. I'd like to follow up with a second minute responding to Chief Justice Phillips' question regarding whether or not this discourages settlement. And then in the last minute, I want to address Justice Enoch's question on which claim came first. If there's one thing that both sides do agree with in this case, it's this, is that the majority opinion applied the wrong standard of review. I would respectfully request that this court take a look at pages 829 and 830 of the majority opinion. In ordering a remittiture, they said, we're going to apply an abuse of discretion standard. This court very clearly, in Larson versus Cactus Utility Company at page 641, said, a court of appeals in ordering a remittiture should do so on an insufficiency of the evidence and not an abuse of discretion standard. So after this court affirmed the judgment of the trial court and the court of appeals on liability, this court must reverse this case and remand it back to the court of appeals so they can apply the correct standard of review on remittiture. And I think both sides...
Do you think there's any federal constitutional problem with our Larson standard as regards punitive damages in light of Hazlitt? Because Hazlitt talks about independent review by a trial court or an appellate court to ensure that a taking has not been accomplished by the jury verdict. And if this same standard that we would ordinarily apply to an evidentiary factor to medical bill damages applies in punitive damages, are we given the required constitutional level scrutiny?
I really don't think, Chief Justice Phillips, that that question is before the court here because...
It may not be, but we might want to notice a footnote or something.
All right. Well, in a footnote, I don't think that this does violate Hazlitt, that the gross negligent instruction was properly submitted, that under the standard review that the appellate court has, it can review all of the facts and apply Krauss versus Alameda National Bank and determine whether there's no reasonable relationship between the actual damages and the punitive damages. And I think only after you do all of that can you then make a determination whether due process has been violated. But we can't get to step three until we do step one. Court of Appeals didn't do step one. They have to review all of the evidence and only order remittiture unless there's factually insufficient evidence.
How do you justify any punitive damages in this case if, in fact, as Mr. Brin said,
the standard which you would apply here has not previously been articulated by any opinion.
Oh, but I think that it has. If this court will
so
take
you
a
and
look,
Mr. Brand are of two minds on.
Well, let me elaborate a little bit. No, I agree with Mr. Brand. I would never disagree with what he had to say. But in Texas, this is a case of first impression under the facts of the case. But there is certainly some authority from other jurisdictions, and I would cite to this court the Brown case and the Davis versus Liberty Mutual, where they specifically had a situation where there was an offer to settle a claim, and they chose not to do that, and instead then later on settled another claim. And that's identical to the facts of this case. And in both of those cases, the court said that's a fact question for the jury to determine whether or not bad faith was committed. And that's exactly what we have here. It's a question, a fact question for the jury to determine. And so, yes, there, to answer your question, there is authority that farmers could have followed but chose not to from other jurisdictions, and it's published in various articles, and they chose not to do that, and it's certainly a basis for the imposition of punitive damages. I'd also like to say one other thing in my last remaining time is that the key issue in this case is the first-come, first-served rule advocated by farmers. And this court threshold issue is what came first? Was it the Lopez offer to settle? This gets back to Justice Enoch's question. Was the Lopez offer to settle, or was it the Medina offer to settle? And I would cite to the court these references to the record. Request for admission 9A and 9B. Please take a look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 1. At a very minimum, farmers had both offers to settle before them at the same time. And under that situation, they chose not to settle the most serious claim. And I would refer the court to pages 304 and 316 of the Statement of Facts.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court, and I'll only address a few of the points and not precisely in order. Mr. Nye's points about the majority's erroneous application of the standard of review are hypothetical on the ground that there is no basis whatsoever for punitive damages in this case. It's been admitted twice now that there's no Texas authority requiring farmers to do what Mr. Soriano says it should have done. In addition, I think Judge Phillips' question raises a point worth considering. There is a constitutional problem, and I'm not going to get into all the briefs on that, but I do want to point out that the newest pronouncement from the U.S. Supreme Court on punitive damage, the TXO case, had two key facts that justified punitive damages. One was that there was an established tort committed in that case, kind of like the first case you heard argued, this slander of title. And the second point was that the jury found that TXO, through its senior officers, committed slander of title with malice. Here we have before the court a point that is granted. There is not even a jury finding that any senior officer, that a vice principal or a managerial employee of farmers committed any conduct that would justify an award of punitive damages, even if you ignored that there's no prior case law that would warn farmers that it needed to behave as Soriano would have farmers behave.
I'm puzzled by, just as I think my question shows some impatience with how this standard of the most serious case could always get all the money. I'm puzzled by what standards you would have. You admitted earlier that if all the money available had been paid to the least serious claim, farmers would have some duty. An insurance company can't do that.
I think that the weight of the case law would probably let them have an issue if all the money had gone. And that's part of our problem.
What if it's $19,999? Same question. $19,999 to Lopez and $1 to
One point that we don't have, and this is a dichotomy between Texas jurisprudence and out-of-state law, there really never has been, at least at this court, a bad faith case that is also a Stowers case, at least that this court has written on. Stowers is a negligence theory premised on agency principles. This court reviewed, or at least the Commission of Appeals reviewed in the old Stowers case. The cases from other jurisdictions proceed on bad faith, but
it is not the kind of bad faith this court has articulated in the Miller's Casualty versus Lyon and National Union versus Dominguez cases. Instead, it is some slight variant of Stowers' law. Stowers seems to be more of a duty on the insured than bad faith case law imposes in the, excuse me, duty on the insurance company than bad faith case law imposes on liability insurers in the other states. The problem, though, is that the duty imposed by Stowers expressly goes only up to the policy limit, and we're just in a situation where it is absolutely impossible with $20,000. The evidence is there's no way that all the Medina claims could have been settled. There's no way that the Lopez claims also could have been settled for that money. We have an impossible situation, and there's nothing we can really do. We didn't get to argue our bad faith.
But how would you articulate the standard? If the insurance company is not in the absolute position of being able to play God with that $20,000, and it would lie, you know, just in whatever way it wants to, and you admit that, then how? What standard do we articulate in this case that the law or the finder of fact or the giver of the law can apply?
If the initial settlement, even arguably, would threaten the insurance company with Stowers' liability, then the insurance company is immune from review. A question was asked by Justice Enoch whether there could have been a Stowers suit had the Lopez claim not settled. We have Van Huseman admitting on the record that the Lopez people could have taken an assignment from Soriano, and they would have had a Stowers claim. Now,
couldn't take it if Soriano acceded to the settlement.
I didn't understand.
You couldn't take an assignment if Soriano acceded to the settlement. In other words, if the insured, her would say to the insured, we have all these claims, which one do you want to settle for $20,000? And the insured says that one. Then he could no longer complain that the insurer had not done what he wanted.
Assuming this court is going to hold that defenses like waiver and estoppel apply to bad faith claims, and we hope the court will hold that comparative bad faith is going to apply ultimately if this kind of claim is recognized. But I think you're right that he would not be in a position, he would be estopped, and he would also have waived any right to complain about the settlement.
And if he said, that's your problem, you pick, then it's kind of hard to argue bad faith in a circumstance like that, isn't it?
Yes. And may I cite one exhibit on the bad faith point? This is the one exhibit in the record. Mr. Nye has pointed out that there is case law that Farmers chose not to follow. He cited two cases. We've cited dozens of cases that said we have a right in good faith to settle the Lopez case. This is Defendant's Exhibit Farmers Number 2, Volume 8. It's pages 84 to 86. And it is a memorandum that is in Farmers' file. It was admitted in evidence. And it points out that if you don't settle immediately with anyone who makes a reasonable settlement offer, you're subject to excess liability. The Gwynn case holds, and in the Court of Appeals, that it is not just the interest of the insured that has to be considered. Both the interest of the insured and the insurance company can be considered. It is admitted in this record that the Lopez claim could have given rise to Stowers' liability, so we have the insured's interest and the insurance company. The insurance company had a right to consider its own Stowers' vulnerability. It did nothing wrong, and the findings in this case and the evidence do not support this judgment.
And one other question, that is, what is wrong with Mr. Brand's suggestion that the insured, her, as an agent for the insured, simply try to do the most he can with what he's got to buy the insured the most protection?
I have no problem with that suggestion. I think that was done, and Mr. Jackson testified that it was the right decision what was done. Mr. Allison testified that it was the best deal Soriano could have gotten.
But the jury, there were others to the contrary, and the jury.
Right, but the jury did not find, it was not asked to find, and it did not find that it was unreasonable or negligent to settle the Lopez case. And I know the court's looking at the preservation issue, but I also want the court to rule on whether Soriano waived that issue under Rule 279. We cited the Glen Fall Insurance versus Peters case.
Well, let me just ask you this. If there had been a charge to your liking that emphasized Lopez, you don't have any problem with this being a jury case in this situation. it's left to find your fact to resolve whether or not you met this test, doing the best you could to minimize the exposure of your insurance.
It'll take about three sentences to answer, if I may. If that issue had been submitted squarely, I think we would still appeal, and our point would not be as forceful because we wouldn't have the fact that we were denied a jury trial on that issue. Under the Gwynn case, we are entitled to consider our own interests when we are faced with a Stowers lawsuit, either way we go. So the mere fact that a jury might reasonably find that it is that the Medina claims are more dangerous than the Lopez claims, that doesn't solve the problem that we are stuck with a Stowers suit that we can't get a summary judgment on.
So your answer to Judge Hank's question is actually no. You do have a problem with that.
Well, that kind of testimony was given. I mean, our people are good people, and they try to protect their insurers, even when, as here, they kill people right and left, and they only have $20,000 of coverage. They did the best they could. And the testimony that has been cited is, yes, you try to do the best you can with the money you have. But I just didn't want to get into the position of conceding that if this issue is submitted, that this is an issue that a Duval County jury should be deciding instead of a court as a matter of law.
But one final question. If farmers believe in good faith that the claimant in Lopez's position could make a $20,000 demand, they could put you in a Stowers position. Could they settle for conceitedly the less serious claims for the entire policy?
Then I would still take the position we're entitled to consider our interest, but I could see the court ruling that there might be a requirement of asking the insured what the insured wants done in the situation. Because the
why, when we know in reasonable probability the insured is going to suffer an excess judgment? We know the lottery. I mean, there's a lot of ways that anybody in Texas could become non-judgmental. And why shouldn't that always be the insurance company?
Well, Your Honor, we've heard a lot of talk about how Sanchez wasn't the law when we settled with Lopez. We also know, though, that there was a gross negligence claim pleaded. Forgetting the substance for a second, suppose you have, and I'll just pick a name, Ernest Cannon in Matagorda County. And you can talk all about the law, but all the testimony in here is that if all things are equal, there's some evidence that the Lopez claims weren't as dangerous as the Medina claims. But we all know that who the judge is, who the lawyers are, what the venue is, makes a big difference. So we're kind of being asked to put on a crystal ball to solve a problem that's insoluble.
Any questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument. And the second call, the court will take another recess.